airdrops of aid to Gaza. The U.S. and five other nations are involved. Our reporter joins one of the flights run by the Kingdom of Jordan.
They carry different kinds of aid. Sometimes they carry food. Sometimes they carry diapers for babies, baby formula.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. As Russians head to the polls, there's little doubt Vladimir Putin will win again.
It's rather hard to whip up any excitement.
Some Russians say this vote still matters.
In Denmark, a plan to draft women into the military, and for the Olympics, a French Malian singer is slated to perform.
She's very successful, not only in France, but in Africa, in Asia, and even in America. She's a big star.
Yet some in France are opposed. That's today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. The top Senate Democrat, Chuck Schumer, delivered a pointed speech today on the Senate floor. Schumer said that Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has, quote, lost his way and is an obstacle to peace. Schumer added that it's time for Israel to hold new elections and that the country is in danger of becoming an international pariah because of the war in Gaza.
The Netanyahu coalition no longer fits the needs of Israel after October 7th. The world has changed radically since then, and the Israeli people are being stifled right now by a governing vision that is stuck in the past.
The Israeli Prime Minister's party accused Schumer of attempting to undermine the country's democracy and used the derogatory term banana republic to describe how Schumer is treating Israel. The Biden administration says the U.S. military plans to build a temporary pier off the coast of Gaza for getting more badly needed humanitarian assistance into the Palestinian territory. A ship carrying 200 tons of aid left Cyprus on Tuesday.
Meanwhile, the United States and five other countries are continuing with airdrops of humanitarian aid into Gaza. The Israeli military says that 1,000 aid packages had been dropped into the Gaza Strip over the past week. One of the countries participating in the airdrop program is Jordan. The world's Shirin Jafari is in the capital, Amman, and was on a plane doing one of those aid drops today, an aircraft of the Royal Jordanian Air Force. I want to start, Shirin, by asking you why the Jordanians are doing these aid drops. What are the ways aid is getting into Gaza right now?
Well, Marco, there are very limited ways that aid is getting into Gaza, and they have to airdrop supplies because aid groups say Israel has effectively made it impossible for aid to get into Gaza. And they also say that once the aid does get in, there are challenges in distributing it. Gaza has been cut off from the outside world since the war began on October 7th. And as a result, more than 500,000 people are facing starvation, according to the United Nations.
Right. So it's a challenge to get aid in. And as you said, it's not the end of the challenge once it is in Gaza. Explain.
Because there is so little food in Gaza, when a small amount does get in, large crowds gather to grab whatever they can. And in the past, Israeli forces have opened fire on them, saying that they felt threatened. In fact, just today, there are reports that Israeli troops killed at least 6 people in Gaza City as they were waiting for food and humanitarian help. So getting aid into Gaza is one thing, and then distributing it and getting it to those who need it is another.
What does it actually take to get these planes over Gaza? I mean, this is a war zone. Missiles are flying. There must be a lot of negotiations in the background.
Oh, absolutely. Listen, at the end of the day, this is an active war zone. And one key issue is to de-conflict, which means every flight has to be cleared by the Israelis so that they're not accidentally shot down. And in general, there is a lot of sensitivity around these flights. For example, today, as I was on the plane, an official with the Jordanian military told me I can't film when we get over Gaza because recently when other journalists have been on these flights and they have filmed and published reports about the level of destruction that they've seen, that has created problems with the Israelis. So the Jordanians want to focus on getting food and aid into Gaza, and they don't want anything that would jeopardize that.
Right. So today, Shirin, you were aboard one of the planes that took off that airdropped humanitarian goods into Gaza.
Yeah, and Marco, it's one of those things where the Air Force calls you the night before with the time to meet, and they don't really include any details. So you really find out what's going on the day, and that's what happened with us today. At the King Abdullah II military base near Amman, Jordan, large cargo planes stand ready. Their rear doors are open, looking like the mouth of a giant whale. Men in military fatigues load pallets of food aid into the plane. They look minuscule compared to the size of the C-130.
So we can see a couple of different planes getting ready to fly. One of them is Egyptian. We just spoke to a group of Americans getting ready to fly. And then there are other countries as well. So these flights have been taken off almost on a daily basis from Jordan, and they carry different kinds of aid. Sometimes they carry food, sometimes they carry diapers for babies, baby formula. And depending on the need on the ground, they adjust their load.
Once everything is loaded, the engines start. The flight to Gaza is short, about 45 minutes. Through small oval windows, we can see the outside. It's a sunny, bright day. A few puffy clouds here and there. As we approach Gaza, the men get busy once again. They clear the way for the pallets to be dropped. They put on and check each other's parachutes for safety, in case they somehow get pulled out of the plane. We descend some more, and Gaza starts to appear. What we see from the plane's small window is a Gaza Strip that has been more or less leveled.
So we are now over Gaza. There's a lot of destruction that we can see from above here.
Rows of collapsed buildings and mounds of rubble stand in stark contrast to the pristine sandy beach and the turquoise water of the Mediterranean. The crew gesture to each other using hand signals. The giant door of the plane opens, sunlight gushes in. The aid parcels drop one by one. Their red parachutes open and they descend into Gaza. This plane dropped 16 pallets of aid today. Will it reach those who need it? Will it give a malnourished child more of a fighting chance? No one on this plane knows. The job here is done. Time to make the short journey back to Amman. Airdrops are the least effective or efficient way to deliver aid, but in the case of Gaza, they could mean the difference between life and death. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari, on board a Jordanian aid flight over Gaza.
You can hear more of Shirin's reporting and all of our coverage of the Israel-Hamas war. It's all online at theworld.org.
The government in Denmark says it wants to achieve full equality between the sexes. That is one reason it gave for a new plan to conscript women into the Danish military. The government is also increasing the service time for both men and women. We asked Catherine Beau Benega to explain the role women already play in the Danish armed forces. She researches gender and military from Aalborg University.
Since 1998, women have actually been able to serve in the Danish armed forces. And so, of course, they contribute to military services for the army and the air force and so forth. So they have the right to be there, right? And they can take on any military engagement there. But at the moment, we still only have around 9% of women in total. Of course, for some fields, it's more. But we do have women. We just don't have that many women serving in our own forces.
And give me some context here. What other countries already conscript women?
Normally, we would compare us to the other Nordic countries, right? So Norway and Sweden are countries that we normally sort of think we look alike. And in Norway, they've had conscription for women since 2015. And in Sweden, it was 17, I think. You know, they've had it this for a very long time, but we just haven't sort of included that in our system. So it's quite interesting that now we see that this is also the way that we want to move in terms of our armed forces.
Yeah, I was curious whether women will actually be drafted, called into service if they don't volunteer, or are there enough volunteers already in Denmark that won't be necessary?
At the moment, right, it's all voluntary because there are so many young people who want to join the armed forces. But then this conscription period is only 4 months, right? So what will be interesting to see is if they succeed with this plan and it will be 11 months, will there then be enough young people who want to join? And of course, they also want to increase the number of men and women who are going to fulfill this.
I'm curious how Danish women specifically are reacting to this news. What are you hearing from folks?
Today, I think you hear from the female veterans union that they are quite pleased about this, but that they are also concerned about the, you know, the military culture as it is. They are pro-conscription for women, but they also want to see changes within the armed forces then in terms of, yeah, this military culture and making it then a place where women also feel comfortable. But actually, it was also interesting to hear interviews from high schoolers today where both, you know, young women and men thought it was the right thing to do, right, to have conscription for both men and women. So that's also really interesting if you sort of look to the generations that in the coming years are going to be the ones that will be affected by this, that they actually think it's a good idea, at least that's some of the comments that has been done today.
Have you heard any of the opposite reaction? Is anyone not so thrilled about this?
There's always, of course, people who are against conscription in general, right? And you see that also on the political wing, that there are some of the parties who are against conscription altogether, and some that are still very prone to the idea that military service is something that men should do and not necessarily women. And of course, you will also hear those reactions in Denmark from all spectres of the political parties, but it has, in general, been very positive from the political parties. And I haven't heard that many negative comments, but we'll see what happens. I think also right now it's early days. Mm-hmm. And so we don't know what it will look like. And we don't know if it will actually pass. And if they don't follow up with funding to actually implement some of the policies that are actually also needed for changing culture within the military, then there might be more critical voices in actually trying to include women in the armed forces.
The Prime Minister has called this a rearming aimed at avoiding war. How much is this a result of security concerns and of course, specifically the Russian invasion in Ukraine?
You know, Denmark has taken a really strong position in terms of Ukraine and being able to actually also build up our own defense. And so what we're seeing right now is a large increase in our military spending, right, and really a commitment to trying to live up to NATO's 2%, right? So that's really part of the discussions and the argumentation, especially from the Prime Minister, right, that we need to take responsibility for our own security and to participate in terms of our NATO allies. And what I think is also interesting that she came out and said, I think it was yesterday, is that conscripts should now also then be able to be deployed, right, for instance, to the eastern flank or to the Baltics, not, you know, to hardcore, you know, combat missions, but it should still be possible to actually deploy.
Catherine Biau-Benega researches gender and the military at Aalborg University in Denmark.
When the internet goes down, work, school, and just about everything else come to a standstill. That was the experience today for people in a dozen countries across Africa when major telecom cables failed. MTN Group, one of Africa's largest network providers, said the disruptions were ongoing and pointed to failures in multiple major undersea cables. A group that documents outages like this said today's disruption was out of the ordinary. The cause is not yet known.
The impact from such cable failures worsens as networks attempt to reroute traffic around the damage. That can end up limiting connectivity for other countries that were not initially impacted. Most of the problems today were reported across West Africa, especially in Ivory Coast, but network operators as far away as South Africa also reported issues.
She's a French singer with fans across the globe, but the idea of a black foreign-born performer representing France as a nation at the Olympics, some apparently are not okay with that. That story's coming up. You're listening to The World.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. French singer Aya Nakamura has some new music out. This track is called Ipe. It's getting rave reviews so far, though that is not why Aya Nakamura is in the headlines this week. Rumors are flying that she's been asked to be the main performer at the opening ceremony of the Paris Olympics this summer. And some people say Nakamura is not the right person for the job. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
By many accounts, Nakamura is the most popular French singer in the world right now. She was the first French-speaking woman to pass 1 billion streams on Spotify, and she was the platform's most streamed French artist last year.
She's very successful, not only in France, but in Africa, in Asia, and even in America. She's a big star.
That's Christelle Maroula, a journalist who covers arts and culture in France. She says Nakamura first made international waves in 2018 with her song Dja Dja. Nakamura's genre-busting music combines R&B, pop, and Afro beats. The 28-year-old was born in Mali in West Africa and moved to a suburb of Paris as a young child. That's where she grew up and rose to stardom, reaching heights like gracing the cover of French Vogue. But this week, some are saying Nakamura is not French enough.
Le sujet, c'est est-ce que ça représente la culture française? Est-ce que ça représente la langue française? Est-ce que ça représente l'élégance française?
Et les Français, far-right politician Marion Maréchal went on national TV questioning if Nakamura should represent the French language and culture at the Olympics. A small far-right group known as the Natives shared the same sentiment when they hung a banner by the River Seine saying, quote, "There's no way, Aya. This is Paris, not the Bamako market." Bamako is the capital of Mali, where Nakamura was born. French sports minister Amélie Oudou-Castéra is among those calling out these responses as racist.
Ce type d'attaque, non, en aucune façon, une place dans notre pays et à l'occasion des Jeux. C'est juste pas possible. Ça m'a vraiment écœurée.
Oudou-Castéra said there's no place for racism in France or at the Paris Olympics, and she was disgusted to hear the criticisms. Politician Marion Maréchal said on TV that her opposition to Nakamura has nothing to do with the fact that she's black.
Pardon, mais excusez-moi, la France qui ne chante pas français, parce que cette chanteuse, on aime ou on n'aime pas, mais elle ne chante pas en français.
Maréchal and other critics say the singer doesn't sing in French. Christelle Maroula says it is French, just French slang.
In France, slang is argot, and it's a very specific language.
Maroula says it includes words you won't find in the dictionary and is often heard in hip-hop and working-class cultures. One example is the name of Nakamura's hit song, Dja Dja, which refers to a man who lies to a woman.
It's a lot of words which is used by many people since a lot of years, since decades.
People of all races use these words, Maroula says, and that's where the difference lies.
When white rappers use the same words, it's shit, it's art. But when it's Aya Nakamura, which speaks this language since she's very young, it's an insult to the French language.
Liliane Thuram, a former pro soccer player for the French national team, said on TV that this week's controversy is indicative of the countrywide issue with anti-black racism.
Parce que moi, lorsque j'étais joueur de foot, il y avait aussi des personnes qui disaient qu'en fait, c'était pas l'équipe de France parce qu'il y avait trop de personnes noires.
Thuram says during his career on the field, people said the national team wasn't the French team because there were too many black people. In a statement to The World, the Paris 2024 Organizing Committee said, quote, "We were very shocked by the racist attacks against Aya Nakamura in recent days. We offer our full support to the most listened to French artist in the world." As far as her performing at the opening ceremony, they said they would not be confirming or denying any performers in advance. The ceremony will take place on July 26th. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
In Haiti, heavily armed gangs have seized control of most of the capital, including roads and ports. Alexander Coswell is with the Caribbean Policy Research Institute in Kingston, Jamaica. He argues that we should not think about this as a gang problem. In Foreign Policy magazine, he argues this is actually a political insurgency.
What we've seen in Haiti now, it's clearly a war against the government. Critical infrastructure has been targeted. We see police stations across the country being bombed and raided for weaponry. Mm. It has all the hallmarks of a civil war. It's just that we keep labeling these non-state armed groups as gangs rather than insurgents.
So how would you suggest approaching their ideology, whether they're an insurgent or a gang, their ideology or pattern of violence differently?
Well, one thing you have to understand about the Haitian political context is that the gangs, they have always been connected to one political group or another. And so the most prominent gang, headed by those warlord with the nom de guerre barbecue, he's previously linked to the assassinated president, Jovenel Moïse. They've been clients of political officials for some time. And that's the case with all these gangs. You can look at the gangs as the armed wings of different political officials. Mm.
And you argue that nothing short of a military intervention will bring Haiti back from the brink of anarchy. Given that you see this as an insurgency, what do you think a successful intervention would look like?
Well, those so-called gangs, well, what I call criminal insurgents, they're heavily armed. The police force, the 1,000 Kenyan police supposed to be deployed, are trained to protect critical infrastructure, but they're not trained to wage war. They're not trained to engage the gangs as enemy combatants, which is what needs to happen if we have any hope of returning Haiti to some semblance of normalcy. This requires getting into a shooting war with these heavily armed gangs who now have much of the weaponry that used to belong to Haitian security forces.
So are you saying that inevitably the way to pacify Haiti is probably going to be through a shooting war?
I don't see another way, because let's say you land Kenyan police into Port-au-Prince, it's not going to be enough to be guarding critical infrastructure. You're going to have to engage with the armed factions on the ground because they are preparing to resist.
And do you believe you've seen evidence that they're ready to do that?
Oh, I think there is no doubt. I mean, because we're not just talking about this very loudmouth figure named Barbecue. There are more interesting characters, let's put it that way. Particularly, there's a character named Guy Philippe, who was recently released from U.S. prisons and deported back to Haiti. He's already gathered a following of armed gangs to join up under his command. And they're openly talking about revolution.
Alexander, do you see any path to making Haiti governable again that does not lead to street-to-street battles?
If we can get this transition government going and we can launch a substantial intervention, that intervention has to be accompanied by a engineering contingent that will carry out emergency infrastructure work. If you look at what the U.S. did in 1915 when they occupied Haiti, that's one of the first things they learned. The reason why rebellions occur so frequently in Haiti is because of the lack of infrastructure. And it's hard for a central government to govern the entire country. And they settled to build an extensive road network that made the country more governable. That's, you know, the U.S. intervention in 1915, that's thought of as a failure, but the key successes of it is that it did carry out the infrastructure work that made the country governable for some time. But that work needs to be done again so that a democratic government can continue to hold Haiti.
Alexander Causewell there with the Caribbean Policy Research Institute. You're listening to The World. The British government is forming a new, broader definition of what it means to be engaged in extremism. But even members of the ruling party worry where that could lead.
In separating the definition of extremism from actual violence and harm, we may criminalise people with a wide range of legitimate views and have a chilling effect on free speech.
Redefining extremism, still ahead here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. The final 24 hours before an election can be filled with political drama and feverish speculation about who will win. This is definitely not the case in Russia. There's a presidential election there this weekend, and there is no question about who's going to come out on top. Vladimir Putin is expected to secure his fifth term in office. He's been at the height of political power in Russia since 1999. Still, some Russians feel it's important to monitor the election closely. The World's Daniel Offman reports from Riga, Latvia.
Last week, Putin traveled to Stavropol in southern Russia. His appearance there was broadcast on Russian state TV. During a surprise visit to local Stavropol neighborhood, dozens of people are clamoring to get closer to the president. This is the image that the Kremlin is looking to present. The president campaigning and, in his way, participating in the democratic process. Last week, Putin's press secretary, Dmitry Peskov, praised Russia's democratic system. We will no longer tolerate criticism of our democracy, he said. Our democracy is the best, and we're going to keep building it.
It tries, as any autocracy does, to survive, to
retain power and to retain itself, to remain what it is.
That's Ekaterina Shulman, a political scientist with the Berlin-based Carnegie Russia Eurasia Center.
No political system rules just by force and fear. Some degree of legitimacy is necessary. That's why there's so much fuss in autocracies about this propaganda, about this producing of impressions, this industry of impressions.
Shulman says the Kremlin uses the election to give the president a veneer of legitimacy. The result is predetermined, but the winning percentage and turnout is not. Though over the course of decades, producing results becomes more difficult.
When an authoritarian leader runs for re-elections the fifth time in the last 20 years, it's rather hard to whip up any excitement.
People don't get excited about elections when there's no competition. The three men running against Putin are all handpicked and approved by the Kremlin. Putin's real political opponents are all in jail, in exile, or have been barred from running against him. Last month, Putin's most prominent political rival, Alexei Navalny, died in jail. So despite the war in Ukraine, voters feel that nothing new is in the offing, so they're less likely to show up to the polls. Raman Udot is an independent election analyst. He's now based in Vilnius, Lithuania.
As it usually happens with a person who stays too long in the power, he loses support. They were not able to improve their electoral results by actual real support of the people. They began to do it through falsifications.
Udot says that these falsifications began years ago, at least since 2008, and they happen in various forms, including ballot box stuffing, people voting multiple times, and election officials juicing up the final results. Udot says that over the years of Putin's presidency, the Kremlin changed its attitude towards election monitors like him, who documented election fraud.
Election observation organizations, we were their allies because both of us wanted free and fair elections. But after that, after his real support began to drop, now we are enemies. So that's why they will do whatever possible to prevent us from knowing the actual will of the Russian people.
But even with the fraught relationship with government authorities, election monitors like Udot keep doing their job despite many restrictions.
They commit crimes here and there, and you are like a Sherlock Holmes, you are like a detective. So personally, it's very interesting. It's like more interesting like fishing and hunting. But I'm not hunting for poor animals, I'm hunting for actual criminals.
In the past, Udot would monitor Russian elections in person at polling stations. But now the Kremlin has banned independent election monitors, so Udot and his colleagues focus on data. They use methods such as statistical analysis, video broadcasts of polling stations, and artificial intelligence to document irregularities and report blatant falsifications. Some independent election monitors are still in Russia, people like Oleg Reut.
We will have very limited abilities to monitor this election. But well, we will come as voters, at least while we can come to our own polling station.
Reut says that on top of ballot stuffing and other traditional methods of election fraud, the Kremlin has begun adapting new techniques, like introducing online voting, which can't be verified, and also dramatically extending the presidential election to 3 days. Reut understands that for now, under this government, these practices will continue.
Under such conditions, when results are predictable, there is high level of repression, there is no support from independent observers. People don't believe that elections could change the situation. I know that someday it will be different.
Reut says he wants to be ready for that day, with all the data and knowledge at hand to prevent rigged elections in the future. As for this election, I asked Reut whether he intends on voting.
No. To be honest, no. In the ballot paper, I have no my candidates this time.
Reut says he'll save his vote for a future election, an election that he views as legitimate and worthy to vote in. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman, Riga, Latvia.
This past February was officially the hottest on record. Obviously, that's bad for ski resorts and snow sports in general. And Carolyn, you were intrigued by what else it means for getting outside in the winter, so you started asking questions for our next story.
Yeah, I had heard a lot about a lack of snow being a problem, but I was curious how it impacts people when we lose our ice. So I called up some people in Europe, in the U.S., in Canada, starting with Julian Bacher, who runs an ice fishing resort on a tributary of the St. Lawrence River in Quebec.
So basically all these white and red and white and black are all mine.
He's got 25 cozy-looking cabins he pulls out onto the ice each winter for families to fish inside.
And then we have other outfitters over there. But it basically becomes like, yeah, a little town.
The ice under Bacher's boots was solid when I got a video tour from him last month, but it didn't freeze up enough for him to open until late January, almost a month later than usual.
Well, obviously it has financial impacts, that's for sure. Losing half the revenue, if not more. Usually we open December 26th, which we get a good 2 weeks of Christmas holidays. So that's a very busy time usually for us.
After opening up well after those holidays, Bacher closed in mid-February. The fish always stop running by then, so the season can't be lengthened even if the ice holds out. But he's optimistic that next year might be better.
We keep our heads up and we're still on the ice for just for a month instead of two. And we love what we do, so it's a passion and we keep on working towards that.
Farther north in Canada, winter ice is a lifeline for First Nations communities like Red Sucker Lake in Manitoba. It's home to about 1,100 people, including Vincent Sims.
Our community is isolated. It's a fly-in community.
Meaning usually you can only get there by plane. It's a remote area dotted with lakes and wetlands where all-season roads don't exist. But in the winter, Sims leads the construction of winter roads out of ice and compacted snow.
That's how we get our materials delivered, such as gas and lumber for housing and stuff like that.
Stuff that's too big or expensive to fly in, construction materials, water tanks, can only arrive on trucks over these winter roads. The usual deadline for getting those roads built is January 21st. Sim says that didn't happen this winter.
This year was very late in getting our roads open, like it was raining in February, which has never happened before.
Lakes have to freeze enough to hold 39 tons, and Sim's crews have to pack snow into wetlands until it eventually freezes fast into ice bridges. By early February, that still wasn't happening, and leaders of more than 50 First Nations communities declared states of emergencies.
At the time, yeah, I was concerned that we won't be able to get the roads built in based on the weather.
The roads were finally finished on February 20th, a month behind schedule, but they closed down again this week with warm weather. There are still supplies waiting to get to Red Sucker Lake, so Sims hopes a cold snap is ahead.
There is a big change happening with the seasons. I'm concerned that if this trend keeps happening, there will be one day that we won't be able to build this road and have our material delivered.
Farther south, the Great Lakes are seeing their lowest ever ice coverage this year, and it's been a weird ice year for the state of Minnesota.
Going into mid-January, we had several lakes throughout the state that didn't have any ice on them, which is extremely unusual, and it broke records for latest ice-in dates that we've had.
Nicole Biaggi is the ice safety coordinator for the state of Minnesota, where ice fishing is popular. Biaggi's position was created in 2022 after two particularly dangerous ice seasons.
A lot of people are used to looking at the calendar, and they figure if normally I've been out in January, they just go out without checking.
This year, that's meant trucks, ice houses, and people have fallen through thin ice. Her mandate, in part, is to keep Minnesotans safe as the climate warms.
You can't look at the calendar. We always tell people you need to look at the weather conditions and not the calendar. And so with the way that the weather's been changing, it's been especially important to get the message out.
In the Netherlands, the ice forms less thick and less often on canals and rivers. Tim Brinkhoff says when it does, Dutch people reach for their skates.
During the winter on any given day, you'll see people from all kinds of different ages, from very small toddlers to old people out on their skates.
Brinkhoff is a freelance journalist who grew up outside of Amsterdam. He cherishes memories of visiting his grandparents' vacation house and skating straight from their property.
And you can follow the little river upstream through the forest until it comes out into this huge lake where just hundreds and hundreds of people are ice skating.
Brinkhoff sees skating as a big part of Dutch culture. In his view, it helps bring people together in a country he describes as typically closed off.
in most neighborhoods there isn't a really, you know, neighborly feel. But whenever the rivers and canals froze over, that would be one of the few occasions where everybody from the neighborhood would come out and would actually talk to each other.
But Brinkhoff says that's becoming mostly just a memory. The Netherlands has gotten more than 4 degrees warmer since the early 1900s.
Due to global warming, rivers and canals freezing over has actually become a lot less common. I have younger cousins that were born in the late 2010s. They don't know how to ice skate, which for a Dutch person is really weird.
Some are calling the winter of 2024 a lost season. El Nino has contributed to the higher than usual temperatures, but across the globe, the ice will continue to vanish.
Caracas, the capital city of Venezuela, can be a stressful place to live. Basic services like water and electricity frequently get cut off. The nation's economic crisis makes it hard for people to make ends meet. It's a stark contrast with some of the colorful and vibrant things you might spot in the city, things that are also noisy. Those are bright blue and gold macaws flying in Caracas. Those birds are not native to the city, but hundreds of them fly and perch freely through its neighborhoods, and they formed a special relationship with the city's residents. Manuel Rueda takes us there.
As sunset approaches, a colorful feast gets underway at Hugo Lozada's home, as 20 blue and yellow macaws fly into his garden to feed on sunflower seeds and fruits. Hola. One of the parrots perches on Lozada's head like a big hat and feeds on a banana that he holds in his hand. The bird's about 3 feet long from head to tail.
No, la naturaleza, las aves son una cosa, la naturaleza es algo que a uno le llena demasiado.
Nature and birds just fill me up with joy, Lozada says. In the 1970s, people started to smuggle macaws from the Amazon to Venezuela's capital as pets. They were kept in cages in people's homes, but they're noisy, and eventually people got tired of them and let them fly away. The macaws found palm trees where they could make nests and mango trees that provided them with food. They reproduced over the years, and now hundreds of macaws fly around the city freely in small flocks. Many of them have made friends with people who leave food out on their balconies and terraces.
Son las mejores mascotas que hay. Les da su alimento, limpias aquí.
They're the best pets you can have, says Hugo Lozada. You can even go on vacations, and they'll sort out how to get their own food. Thanks to people like Lozada, the macaws have plenty to eat in Caracas. Also, the city doesn't have any of the big predators that go after these birds in South America's rainforests, like monkeys and eagles. María Lourdes González is a biologist who studies these birds.
In the wild, the success is like one nestling for two nests. Here, they put 3 eggs and survive the 3 eggs. So the population grow and grow and grow.
According to González, there are at least 600 macaws flying around the city that descended from pets. The blue and gold macaw and also the scarlet macaw originated in the Amazon. They mingle with the one local species of macaw, a small apple green one. But only the macaws that descended from pets seem to have little fear of humans.
They teach their nestling to come to humans to get food. And again and again and again, and right now, they love to be in contact with us because we give food to them.
As the birds become increasingly easy to spot, they have become a symbol of Caracas, where they appear in murals and souvenirs. The city's small tourism industry has also jumped on the bandwagon, with some agencies offering macaw spotting tours. In the busy neighborhood of Las Mercedes, the Ololo Hotel attracts the birds to its terrace every morning by leaving out a tray with sunflower seeds. That way, guests can take photos with the birds while they're having breakfast.
The macaws, you know, sort of bring, you know, tourists to us.
Jean-Paul Simon is the hotel's owner.
We do have clients who just come here to have some breakfast, and even though they're not staying with us, they just come here to see the macaw.
However, biologist María Lourdes González says that the macaw's future in Caracas isn't guaranteed. She explained that the birds only nest in old palm trees, whose trunks have been hollowed out by a local insect. But these palm trees don't have leaves, and the city government has been removing some of them because they're not pretty.
Now we have a huge population who need to reproduce, and each year I less spaces for reproduce.
So far, there hasn't been an outcry to save the macaw's habitat. Gonzalez says that eventually, some of the birds might try to migrate.
It's a decision from the people if this population stay in Caracas or have to leave.
Ultimately, the future of these birds depends on humans, who brought them to the city in the first place. For the World, I'm Manuel Rueda, Caracas.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World.
You're with The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The UK has seen a rise in hate crimes against Jews and Muslims since the start of the war between Israel and Hamas. In response, the British government today announced a new official definition for what will be considered extremism. Muslim groups and pro-Palestinian activists in the UK say they're worried that the new rules will be used to target them. Some Conservative Party lawmakers have concerns, too, as The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry reports.
Politics teacher Simon Shaw was among the tens of thousands who marched through central London last Saturday.
It breaks my heart of what is happening in Palestine, that a whole people have been kept in what used to be called an open-air prison, and now I think it would more accurately be called a ghetto.
The march was the 10th demonstration held in the British capital since Israel launched its attack on Gaza following the Hamas assault on October 7th. Earlier this month, Rishi Sunak, the UK Prime Minister, made an impromptu speech outside 10 Downing Street, criticising those marches.
What started as protests on our street has descended into intimidation, threats, and planned acts of violence. And I want to speak directly to those who choose to continue to protest. Don't let the extremists hijack your marches.
The government said today the new definition of extremism will help crack down on Islamist and far-right groups in Britain that Sunak says are infiltrating these protests. The new wording defines extremism as, quote, an ideology based on violence, hatred or intolerance that can be used to negate or destroy the fundamental rights of others. If an organisation is deemed extremist, then it can be blacklisted. That means it will no longer be allowed to hold meetings with state officials or receive government funding. But Muslim groups in the UK are worried that the new rules will be used against them. Zahra Mohammed, head of the Muslim Council of Britain, spoke to the BBC earlier.
But what we feel this government is doing is playing politics with extremism at the expense of certain communities. Now, we've had reports that this is going to be impacting Muslim community groups and Palestinian advocacy groups. Groups like ourselves.
In Parliament this afternoon, Conservative Minister Michael Gove called out the names of five organisations the government deems problematic. Three are Muslim-led groups and two are far-right organisations. The Muslim Council of Britain was not on the list. Incidents of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia have soared in Britain in the last 5 months, according to organisations that work with both Jewish and Muslim communities. Last week, Britain's counter-extremism commissioner said that London has become a no-go zone for Jews on the weekends because of pro-Palestinian marches. Politics teacher Simon Shaw, who's been on those marches, disagrees.
Now, I'm secular, anti-Zionist, culturally Jewish, and I've never felt unsafe to be on the streets of London, and I didn't feel unsafe marching with that banner.
Shaw's banner read, "I'm Jewish and I'm proud to be marching in solidarity with Palestine." He says he's never seen any trouble at the demonstrations, and extremism experts say current laws are robust enough to deal with any unrest.
If we've got a problem with protest, then enforce the legislation that enables you to deal with protest.
Elizabeth Pearson is a lecturer of terrorism studies at Royal Holloway University of London. She's just published a book called Extreme Britain. She says expanding the definition of extremism may actually create further tension between communities.
I mean, a definition, in my view, is not the right way to engage with the problem of polarisation. What you really want for something like this is a proper path of leadership through this. Any new definition seeks to problematise those people who are protesting.
Michael Gove, the Conservative minister, said today he hopes that labelling a group extremist will make the public and other bodies shun them. But even lawmakers within the government's own Conservative Party have their doubts about the new rules.
Because in separating the definition of extremism from actual violence and harm, we may criminalise people with a wide range of legitimate views and have a chilling effect on free speech.
That's MP Miriam Cate speaking in Parliament earlier, but Michael Gove said that won't be the case.
Our definition will not affect gender-critical campaigners, those with conservative religious beliefs, trans activists, environmental protest groups, or those exercising their proper right to free speech.
A full list of groups the government deems extremist will be published in the coming weeks. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Staying in Britain for just a minute, the House of Commons is expected to pass a bill that would ban foreign governments from owning newspapers in the UK. The measure would stop a consortium led by the United Arab Emirates from buying the Telegraph Media Group, which publishes three major newspapers. Backers of the bill include Alicia Kearns, chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee. She told lawmakers that foreign ownership is a threat to press freedom.
We see a situation where a paper of record, the Daily Telegraph, and The Spectator, the longest running magazine in the world and my personal podcast of choice, will be purchased by a foreign state. The concern here is not foreign ownership, it is foreign state ownership. And in this situation, you cannot separate Sheikh and state. And these are our concerns.
Kearns was referring to Sheikh Mansour bin Sayed Al Nahyan, the vice president of the UAE. Sheikh Mansour is well known in Britain for transforming the Manchester City Soccer Club into a powerhouse after buying it in 2008. In a statement, the company making the bid for Telegraph Media Group said it was extremely disappointed and that its interest in purchasing the papers is only commercial. The company said the UK's media industry is worthy of more investment and that it would evaluate next steps. The proposal to ban foreign state ownership of UK newspapers is expected to pass easily with support from across the political divide.
As we reported earlier this hour, Russia is holding a presidential election this weekend. As people go to the polls, they're also going in huge numbers to movie theaters to see a film based on the great Soviet-era novel The Master and Margarita.
As we were editing, we were watching news unfolding in Russia, which was kind of cosplaying the scenes that we already had in the movie.
That movie is a story about Soviet censorship, and it's winning over modern Russian audiences.
I think ultimately the fact that it's one of the most beloved novels in Russia allowed it to kind of pass and convince, the authorities to release it.
We speak with the director of The Master and Margarita. Listen for that tomorrow on The World.
The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. You take care. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.